beside you. The look Hank gave me lifted me off my feet and burned into my heart. I was a girl that never had been around boys much, been too busy working and worrying about Papa. I guess Papa had been the man I had been in love with, in a way, more than any other person. But I don't know why Hank's look stung me so deep at that instant. We don't ever know why we fall in love with one person as opposed to another. Let's say I was just a healthy girl that once Papa died was ready to fall in love. You can say it any way you want to, and it still comes out to mean the same thing. I looked right back at Hank, and I couldn't take my eyes away from him. I'd never done anything so bold before, but I couldn't help it. The look may have lasted only a second, but it felt like we was fixed on each other and couldn't break loose. I'd never felt so scared or so inspired. Hank's look filled me with something that was sweeter than the sweetest sleep when you are tired. He flicked the reins again, and the horse stepped up the road. I watched the wagon creak and rattle on the rocks, and Hank straight back where he stood holding the reins. "There's a young man that's proud of hisself," Mama said when he was out of hearing. "I reckon so," I said. Mama looked at me and seen how I was blushing. I never could hide a thing from Mama, and she must have seen that look Hank and me had traded. "Don't go getting ideas," Mama said. "You're not but 17, and you know we need you on the place." "Wouldn't dream of it," I snapped. But I wasn't thinking about what I was saying. I was watching Hank's straight shoulders as he rode through the spotlights and dapples of sun that come through the oak trees, and I was wondering if he had seen my bare feet. I wiggled my toes in the leaves. "Take hold of that saw," Mama said. "We've got to finish this log." "Yes, ma'am," I said. The very next Sunday, Hank come to church on the mountain. He wore a gray suit of clothes like he was from town. He must have just bought the suit, for it looked brand new. I saw him standing outside the church when we arrived. The other young men and boys was slouching on one side of the door, and Hank was standing on the other by himself. The Willards always said they wouldn't let boys from any other community come to court girls on the mountain. Hank touched his hat as I walked past him up the steps. I didn't know if I should speak to him or not, since that would tell all the other boys he had come courting me. I glanced at Hank and walked by quick, but I had seen that look in his eye like there wasn't nobody in the world except me and him. Something thrust up in my heart like water busting from a fountain. All through preaching, I could feel Hank's eyes on the back of my head and neck. He had come in and sat down on the last bench with the backsliders and sinners and most of the boys in the community. I reckon they elbowed and shoved each other and throwed lit matches in each other's laps during service like they always did. They didn't get a bit of good out of preaching, and the rest of us ignored them. Soon as service was over, I dreaded to go outside, for I didn't know what would happen. Would the Willard boys get in a fist fight with Hank? Would they let him get away? I knowed they was rough, mean boys, and I was afraid for him. But soon as I come out the church door following Mama and Rosie, there stood Hank with his hat in his hand like a peddler. "How do?" he said to Mama. "How do, ma'am?" As I stepped by him, he said, "Miss Harmon, may I have the honor of walking you home?" He said it just like he was a lawyer, an educated person from town. Everybody in the churchyard was listening. I couldn't think of what to say. "Why, sure," wouldn't sound right, and "yeah," wouldn't sound polite. All the other girls and the Willard boys and Mama and Rosie and the preacher was watching. Nothing I could think of to say sounded right. So I just nodded, and Hank held out his arm for me to take. As we walked out of the yard, I could feel the pressure of all eyes on me. It was like a high wind coming at my back, pushing the cloth of my dress against my skin. I don't know if I was blushing or not. In the bright sunlight, it didn't matter. Don't ask me what we talked about walking down the road toward our place. I was just aware of holding on to Hank's strong arm. I think he talked about playing the banjo and about how to make a banjo out of the skin of a cat. I think he asked if I sung alto or soprano, and I told him alto. He said he'd thought so. Mama and the other girls walked along behind us, so we didn't have a chance to kiss, even if we had wanted to. People in those days didn't kiss anyway unless they was already serious. We walked up that road, and I thought about what those Willard boys might try to do. And I thought about how Lou and Rosie would tease me. And I thought about how even if Hank never did come back, I would always remember how he had walked me home. A handsome boy from Painter Mountain had walked me home from church. Back at the house, Hank took his hat off and sat on the porch talking to Carolyn while the rest of us helped Mama put dinner on the table. Mama had cooked her chicken before church and kept it warm in the oven. Mama asked Lou if she would take the bucket to the spring for some fresh water. It was a good thing I had killed and plucked the chicken that morning, because we didn't always have chicken on Sunday. I had hoped Hank might show up at church and come home with us. When we finally did sit down to eat, Mama asked Hank to say the blessing. He sat at the head of the table where Papa had sat and bowed his head. "Lord," he said, "for what we are about to receive, make us truly thankful, and for the struggles of this life, make us strong and worthy, and for the beauties of the world, make us humble and grateful." It was an eloquent blessing, unlike any I had heard before. I looked at Hank just as he raised his head and caught his eye for a second. He didn't wink, but it felt like he had winked. Everything went all right at the dinner until I had to go to the kitchen for the coffee. The chicken and rice and peas and peaches was good, and the cornbread was hot and just soft enough. Hank ate plenty of everything. "Mr. Richards, you should have brought your mother," Mama said to Hank. "Ma wouldn't go anywhere but Painter Mountain to church on a Sunday," Hank said. "She would certainly be welcome," Mama said. "Have you ever rode the train?" Carolyn said. Carolyn had not been able to take her eyes off of Hank since he got to the house. "I took the train all the way to Chattanooga one time, looking for a job," Hank said.
"Did you sleep on the train?" Carolyn said.
"It's not polite to ask too many questions," Mama said. "I didn't sleep in a berth," Hank said, "but I took a nap in my seat." We all laughed.
"Have you ever been to Greenville?" Rosie said.
"I go every year, me and my brothers, to sell hams and molasses," Hank said.
"I would love to ride the train to Mount Mitchell," Carolyn said.
Carolyn was wearing one of the pink lacy dresses Mama made for her, the one that had smocking on the front. Finally, Mama said for me to go get the coffee off the stove, and she asked Rosie to bring in the coconut cake she had made. Rosie loved to make coconut cakes, even when she was a girl, and nothing goes better with coffee than coconut cake. There was still a fire in the cook stove, and the coffee was boiling. I took the pot off the stove and carried it to the dining room. But as I got close to the table, I wondered if I should pour the first cup for Mama, who was a woman and the oldest person at the table, or for Hank, who was our guest at Sunday dinner. I couldn't make up my mind, and that flustered me. I took a step toward Mama and then stopped. "Julie, pour some coffee for Mr. Richards," Mama said. That settled it, but the damage was already done. My hand was shaking when I held the heavy coffee pot over Hank's cup. Coffee come out of the spout too fast and splashed out of his cup and on his knee. He jumped when the hot coffee touched him, and I must have screamed as I stepped back. I hit the buffet as I jerked around, and the pot fell to the floor, throwing out a scarf of smoking coffee. "Oh, Julie," Mama said. Hank stood up and knocked the drops of coffee off his pants.
It's nothing, he said. Are you burned? I said.
Not a bit, he said.
Mama ran to the kitchen for towels, and I helped her wipe up the spilled coffee. I'll wash her pants, I said to Hank. It's just a spot, he said. I finished mopping up the coffee and carried the pot and wet towels to the back porch. Through my carelessness, I had ruined everything. Everything. I figured Hank would just get his hat and go as soon as it was polite. He would get away from all us girls gawking at him and Carolyn flirting and Mama calling him Mr. Richards. I know there was a lot of girls prettier than me closer to Painter Mountain, girls not so clumsy and nervous. But I was wrong. Hank did get his hat, but he said, Julie, show me where the spring is. I need a drink of cold water after that fine hot dinner. There was no way I could refuse to show him where the spring was. I wiped my hands on a dry towel and hung it on the nail by the stove. Somebody can bring a bucket of fresh water from the spring, Mama said. I want to drink it cold from the ground, Hank said. It was the brightest day you ever seen outside, bright as only early fall can be. The grass and leaves on the trees and even the bare dirt appeared to sparkle. I don't know if it was the light or the fact that I was falling in love that made everything shine. The world was lit in a new way, and I was lit up in every finger and toe and part of me. Our spring was down the hill behind the house, below the big walnut tree. The spring was hid by laurel bushes, so it was always in shade. It was the boldest and the coldest spring on the mountain. Water pushed out from the sides of the spring, boiling up the white sand on the bottom and stirring the flecks of mica. There was little lizards around the edges of the pool, showing how pure the water was. Hank took the coconut shell off the stick by the spring and dipped out a drink. He offered it to me and I shook my head. He drank the water slow, like he was savoring the flavor and the coldness. This here water tastes like it comes out of a rock, Hank said, like it's been running through rubies and emeralds. It was pretty the way he put it. I wish I had a ruby. I would give it to you, Hank said. I don't need no ruby, I said. Hank dipped up another drink and then replaced the coconut shell on the stick. Now my mouth is sweet, he said. He looked into my eyes and stepped closer. He took my hands and raised them, first one and then the other, to his lips and kissed them. Nobody had ever kissed my hands before. Then he put his hands on my elbows and pulled me closer to him. You are an unusual person, he said, and looked right into my eyes. I couldn't think of any way I had been unusual, except to splash coffee on his britches, but I didn't say that. He leaned closer and nudged my lips with his lips. It tickled and made my lips tingle. He rubbed his lips sideways across mine, and I thought how gentle and careful he was for such a big, strong man. I wondered if Mama or Rosie or one of my other sisters was watching us from the back porch. And then I remembered the laurel bushes was between us and the house. Hank pressed his lips to mine, and the feeling was sweet, sweeter than the fresh water from the spring. Then he nibbled at the edge of my lip, at my upper lip, and the corners of my mouth. He ran the tip of his tongue along my upper lip. It was a feeling I'd never had before. When Hank put his lips full against mine and placed his arms around my shoulders, I felt I was being gathered up in a spin and cut off from the air and light around me. It was like his arms made a separate world around me. His arms and lips and the feel of him against me made us apart from the woods and spring and bushes. We was our own world just by being together. The feeling of the kiss went all over me.
The kiss went through my arms and legs to the tips of my fingers and toes. That was the strangest part. Hank kissed my lips and run his tongue around my lips, and I felt the sweetness in the back of my head and down my back. So this is what kissing is, I thought. And I thought, this is not me. This is better than me. This is better than I deserve. And I thought, no, this is what I have been waiting for. This is what the future is going to be like. Hank kissed me, and we turned around like we was dancing real slow. We stepped around, but I wasn't hardly aware of stepping. I felt the trees and laurel bushes and the spots of sunlight was all circling. Everything was turning as Hank kissed me. My eyes was closed, and I floated with the turning. When Hank took his lips away and breathed, I caught a breath, too. I took a breath and opened my eyes, and looking over his shoulder at the woods, I seen somebody standing among the bushes above the spring. It was the oddest feeling to open my eyes after my first kiss, after an otherworldly kiss, and see somebody staring at us from among the oak trees. It was like waking up from a sweet dream and finding somebody studying you. I knowed it was one of the Willard boys. I think it was Clarence. He must have been watching us all that time. I couldn't know how long he had been watching, but if he was watching us, the rest of them must be watching us, too. There might be half a dozen Willards spying on us. I want you to be careful, I said to Hank. I didn't mean to spoil everything by telling him we was being watched. Careful about what? He said. You just be careful as you go down the mountain, I said. And then I heard a squirrel bark. But it wasn't a regular squirrel. The bark was too steady and a little too loud. It was one of the Willards making the noise, teasing us. And then I heard a bobwhite call, and though it sounded like a bobwhite, the call was too loud. It was another one of the Willards answering the first. Hank must have seen the worry on my face, for he started to listen. Just then a turkey gobbled further up the ridge. There's a lot of varmints about, he said, and laughed. Don't you leave here by yourself, I said. Hank pulled his coat back and showed me a pistol stuck in his belt. They may have guns, too, I said. I know the Willard boys carried pistols with them, especially Webb. Sometimes on Sunday afternoons, they would walk along the road with a .22 and shoot at rocks and cans. Don't you worry, Hank said. Worry never made anybody live a second longer. We walked around the edge of the yard, and Hank held my hand. I think he wanted whoever was watching to see us together. I showed him the garden where the tomatoes were so ripe and many they had broke down the vines, and the summer squash had got so big they looked like yellow geese laying in the weeds. The tater vines was dead, and the bean vines had turned yellow. We walked to the edge of the cornfield where Lou and me had already cut the tops and pulled the fodder. Who did all that work? Hank said. I did some, I said, and Lou helped, and Mama did some. Hank looked at me and run his finger along my cheek. You will make somebody a good wife, he said. I couldn't look into his eyes. I couldn't hardly bear for him to look at me. For I know that more than anything in the world I wanted to be married to Hank Richards. I wanted to live in a house with just him and me, and I wanted to help him work in the fields and raise chickens and pick apples to dry in the sun for winter. It seemed too much to hope for that I could be with him day after day, day and night. It was too perfect to think on. Nothing ever worked out that perfect in this world, and if I wanted it too bad, it would never happen. The world was made so people never got what they wanted most, or maybe they wanted most what they could never get. You will make somebody a good husband, I said. I hoped he didn't think I had cut all the tops in the cornfield by myself. I was a little ashamed of all the hard work I'd had to do. Who is going to help you kill hogs? Hank said. We had ambled close to the hog pen, and the mud of the pen sent its stench over into the sweet smell of the garden. Well, I guess Lou and me and Mama will do it, I said. I could come up and give you a hand, Hank said. You don't have to do that, I said. You'll need help lifting the hog, Hank said. I didn't protest, because I wanted him to come whenever he would, and I didn't want him to think I was able to kill a hog and cut it up all by myself. We walked by the grape arbor where the bees was busy on the ripe concords. Do you ever make wine? Hank said. Papa used to make blackberry wine for his rheumatism, I said, but nobody else ever did drink any. Pokeberry wine is better for rheumatism, Hank said. It warms the joints and soothes them. When we got to the front porch, Mama come out and said she had made a fresh pot of coffee. She asked Hank, did he want any? That would be perfect, he said. I've got to leave soon, but a cup of coffee will set me up for the road. Mama brought out two mugs on a tray, and we sat on the swing on the front porch. I never had coffee except in the morning, but I took the cup just to be sociable. Maybe it was because I was excited and in love, or maybe it was because I wasn't used to drinking coffee in the afternoon, but after a few sips, it felt like lights was going through my veins to the end of my fingers, and the yard and front porch got even brighter and clearer. Everything was so clear it hurt my eyes to look at it. And Hank was so handsome with his black hair and downy mustache and brown eyes and high forehead, it sent a pain through me just to glance at him. I thought I heard Carolyn giggle inside. She must have been watching us through the window. She was nearly 14 and too big to giggle like that. But she was spoiled, and I reckon she was jealous because Hank had come to see me and not her. What if I was to ask you? Hank said. But just then there was a whippoorwill call on the hill above the road. Since whippoorwills never called till after dark, it didn't fool us. It was one of the Willard boys, all right. That bird has got its clock wrong, Hank said. If you was to ask me what? I said. There was a dove call, slow and mournful, from the same place the whippoorwill had called from. Those birds are singing up a regular chorus, Hank said. Those birds ought to be jailbirds, I said. Next it was a mockingbird on the hill, sounding like the other birds, and a rain crow and a robin. And then a fox barked up there, too. The woods is full of noise, Hank said. If you was to ask me what, I said again. There was another bobwhite call, and a fox bark, and then a wildcat scream. What if I was to ask you to be my wife, Hank said. I couldn't believe what was happening. I had only walked home with Hank the first time that morning. Some girls had to wait months, even years, to get engaged. I had first laid eyes on Hank less than a week before, and here he was asking me to get married. It felt like I was dreaming it all. After we kissed and held hands and looked into each other's eyes for what must have been an hour, ignoring the bird calls from the hill and Carolyn's giggles behind the window, Hank said he had to go if he was to get off the mountain before dark. He didn't want to be caught on the mountain after nightfall. Might step on a snake, he said. I'm afraid for you, I said. He kissed me on the forehead. Just do what I tell you to do, he said. What do you want me to do? I said. I want you to hold my hat, he said. He took off his wide-brimmed black hat, and he went to the front door and thanked Mama for dinner. I hope your pants ain't ruined, Mama said. A spot of coffee won't ruin good cloth, Hank said. You come back and see us soon, Mama said. I'll do that, Hank said. Out in the yard, Hank handed me his hat and told me to stand by the front gate and hold it for him. "Where are you going?" I said.
"I'll be back," he said and winked.
And taking off his coat and tucking it under his arm, he headed down the trail to the outhouse. The outhouse was hid behind the arborvitae, and it was right at the edge of the pine woods. I heard the door of the outhouse slam. I smiled, thinking how delicate Hank was about mentioning where he was going. I held the hat and stood there beside the boxwood by the gate. Mama had swept the yard and sprinkled sand on it, but chickens had already tracked the sand and stained it. I would have to carry more sand from the branch for next Saturday. Shadows was getting longer across the yard, and I felt the coolness of evening in the air. A crow called in the pines on the hill. A dog barked down the mountain. After a few minutes, I started to wonder what Hank was doing in the outhouse. Was he sick? Had a spider bit him? It was embarrassing that he had gone there and was staying so long while I held his hat by the road. I looked at the soft felt hat. It must have been a 7 3/4 size, for Hank had a large head. Mama come out on the porch and said, "Is he gone?" I shook my head and pointed toward the outhouse. Rosie and Carolyn come out on the porch behind Mama and looked toward the arborvitae. I hoped Hank wouldn't step out and see them all looking at him. I held the hat and looked down the road, but didn't see anybody. And then I looked up the road and saw the road that way was empty, too. There was a dove call on the hill, and then another bobwhite call. I looked at the hat in my hand, and I looked toward the arborvitae. And then I smiled, because I knowed Hank had already slipped away into the trees and was far down the mountain. I was even more thrilled than I had been to think he was safe and that he had been so clever. "Well, what happened to him?" Mama said. "He's done gone," I said. "He'll have to come back for his hat," Carolyn said. "A gentleman don't go anywhere without his hat." Shadows was already reaching across the yard. There was crow calls from the trees on the hill. I tossed the hat up in the air and caught it. It was the happiest day of my life. Marriage was different from what I ever expected. Like all girls, I imagined something wonderful, and it was wonderful in most ways, but in different ways from what I had thought. Mama had always said that marriage is like everything else. It is work, hard work. As I expected, Mama was angry when I told her I was engaged. "You don't hardly know that boy," she said. "How well am I supposed to know him?" I said. "Well enough to know his mama's name," Mama said. I didn't say nothing. I never was good with talk when somebody was upset. Besides, there was nothing I could say to convince Mama. "When are you getting married?" Lou said.
"Next month," I said.
"Where are you going on your honeymoon?" Carolyn said. She was always reading stories in magazines about courtship and honeymoons. "I don't know yet," I said. "He has only just asked me." "I'll say," Mama said. "You only met him last week."
"I'll bake you a coconut cake," Rosie said. "Who is going to do the work around here?" Mama said.
"The crops is already in this year," I said. "It's not like Rosie and Lou and Carolyn is helpless." "This is a fine come-off," Mama said, "after your papa died in the spring, and you not much more than a young'un." But I don't think Mama was as mad as she acted. Or if she was, she got over it. Maybe she seen the advantage of getting one of her girls married off, or maybe she seen there was nothing she could do to stop it. "I just hope he's a good man," Mama said, "though he's really just a boy."
"He's 18 years old," I said.
"That's what I mean," Mama said. "You're both just young'uns."
Chapter 4. Now, the week before we was married, Hank rented a house over the line in South Carolina. It was way down a little valley called Gap Creek, and it was the farthest I'd ever been from home. Hank said he wanted to live there because it was a pretty place, and because it was cheap, and he had work where they was building a cotton mill at Lyman. He had worked before as a carpenter and mason's helper, and he already had a job lined up at the site in Lyman, helping to make brick. I thought later he moved to South Carolina to get away from his ma, because when I got to know her, I could see why he would want to. We got married on a Saturday, nearly a month after we first met, and we stayed that night at Mama's house. I felt embarrassed to be spending my first night as a married woman in my own house, but Mama knowed what to do. Since there wasn't no extra bedroom, she told Hank to sleep on the couch in the living room, and I stayed in the bedroom with Lou and Rosie and Carolyn like I always had. I didn't get hardly any sleep that night, and Lou giggled and teased me. "Do you reckon Hank is lonesome out on the couch?" she said. "Shh," I said, and pretended to be sleepy. The next day, we walked down to Gap Creek. Like any bride, I thought my husband was wise and on his way to riches. And when I seen the valley of Gap Creek, I thought it was one of the prettiest places in the world. The house wasn't so fancy, but the narrow valley with steep mountains on either side looked like a picture out of a magazine. The valley floor was flat, winding peaceful back into steep mountains. It was still green in the slender cove, though it was already fall on the higher slopes. The worst thing about the house was that Mr. Pendergast, who rented it to us, lived there himself. He lived in the bedroom at the front of the house, and our rent was the meals I fixed for him and the washing I did for him. He was a crusty old widower, and I seen I was going to have to humor him. I was just a young bride, and Hank took me down there to start housekeeping in that little place and to cook for old man Pendergast. Mr. Pendergast was a short man with a huge head of gray hair and hair growing out of his ears. He always looked at you with a squint when he talked. "Don't you worry about me," he said the night we arrived, when I come in with my clothes tied up in a pasteboard box and a pillowcase, after walking all the way from Mount Olivet. "I don't eat hardly nothing, and I'm so quiet you'll never know I'm around." He showed me where the kitchen was and where all the pots and pans was. His wife had died 3 or 4 years before, and he had let the house go the way most men would. Every inch of the floor needed to be scoured and scrubbed. You never seen such filth as was built up around and behind the cook stove. I seen it would take me a week to get the place cleaned up so it didn't turn your stomach. "What do you like for breakfast?" I said. "Just fix me some biscuits and gravy," Mr. Pendergast said, "and maybe a poached egg." I had heard of poached eggs, but I had never made a poached egg. I'd have to ask Hank what a poached egg was. "We won't have no bacon until we kill the hog," Mr. Pendergast said, "but it's almost time for hog killing." Later, when we went to bed that first night, I was almost afraid to move in the attic bedroom, for the floorboards creaked and the bedsprings creaked. And I was afraid Mr. Pendergast was right below us, listening to every sound we made. The floorboards groaned and the bedsprings moaned when we got in. "Shh," I said to Hank. "Pendergast is deaf as a fence post," Hank said, not even lowering his voice. "Even a fence post can hear this bed creak," I said. After Hank blowed out the lamp, we laid in the bumpy bed in the room smelling of old wood and smoke. Hank turned over to face me, and the springs banged on the slats of the bed. I giggled, 'cause I was a little nervous. But I wasn't scared or worried like so many brides are supposed to be. I had thought all my life about this first night in our own house, and now that it was here, I was more worried about waking up Mr. Pendergast than anything else. "Shh," I said again. When Hank put his lips to my ear, it felt so odd and good it made me shiver. And when he put his finger on my nipple, it felt like funny bones all over my body had been touched. When he run his hand over my shoulder and under my armpit and down to my belly, I thought little sparks must be jumping off my skin in the dark. I felt something pulling my nightgown up over my knees and over my thighs and over my belly. I giggled, and the bed creaked as Hank moved over me. And then I felt something hot and wet in my belly button, and I knowed it was Hank's tongue going in and out and round the navel. He licked the little hairs around my navel and stuck his tongue in the hole. I hope there wasn't any lint in there. It was all so strange and different from what I had imagined. I didn't hardly know what was happening. It was like the world had been tilted and turned in some way, and time had stopped or slowed down. Time had been turned on its side and moved in a curve. When Hank got on top of me and rocked the bed, I felt numb with his weight, and I heard the headboard of the bed knock on the wall. I thought of Mr. Pendergast below listening. I wondered if this was it. Was this what everybody talked about and thought about so much? Stop, I wanted to say. You stop that. But I couldn't. You quit that, I thought of saying, but I didn't. As Hank rocked faster, the bedpost scooted on the floor a little. What he was doing hurt a little, but it felt good, too. A sweet hurt, a hot sweetness. Oh, I said, and I thought, you'll have to stop this. We can't go on like this, for I was getting short of breath, and Hank was getting short of breath. Stop that, I thought. Or maybe it was, don't stop. Don't stop now. Don't stop. All the colors started running through my head in the dark. Purples and greens and yellows and blacks. They blended into each other and poured over each other. And the colors was like milk, so soft and warm and pouring over and into each other. And the colors was swelled, bigger than I ever had thought they could be. The colors was melodies, like shape notes singing. Now quit this, I thought. We've got to stop or we'll wake up old man Pendergast. We'll wake up the chickens in the hen house, and we'll wake up the horse and the hog in the pen. We'll even wake up the stars over the mountains and the birds roosting under the eaves of the barn. But the colors poured on behind my eyes, the purples and blues, the salty colors like orange and yellow. Yellow is salty as butter and popcorn. Yellow was swelled up and buttery. And there was a golden brown that was saltiest of all. And I felt a sneeze coming down there. It was the best feeling of a sneeze coming right out of my middle and swelling through me to get rid of what I was holding back. And I sneezed quick and again. It was the sweetest ka-choo and ka-choo. So deep and full it hurt, too. Hank was shoving, too, and pushing with his feet against the foot of the bed like he was running while laying down or dancing while laying down. And there was a wrench of boards and a squeal of nails pulling out. We fell and slammed onto the floor. It sounded like the house had fell down, but I knowed what had happened, even though it was dark and I couldn't see. That old bed had pulled apart and the footboard had fell away. The springs and mattress had slid onto the floor. I was laying on the floor, and I knowed Mr. Pendergast must have woke up beneath us. But I giggled a little, and Hank put his head on my neck and giggled too. We was both tired out, and it felt good just to lay still. I listened to see if Mr. Pendergast was moving around below. But all I could hear was my own breathing and Hank's breathing. And then something crashed, and I could tell it was the headboard of the bed falling over on the floor. Lord of mercy, I said in the dark. I thought I heard somebody laughing below, but I couldn't be sure. It might have been a screech owl off in the woods or wind in the eaves. My first trouble with Mr. Pendergast come the next morning when I fixed his breakfast. Hank got up early to go to the mill at Lyman where he was helping to tend the brick kilns. I fixed him some biscuits and butter and jelly to take in his lunch pail. After he was gone, I went ahead and boiled a saucepan of water to fix Mr. Pendergast's poached egg. Hank had said a poached egg was just a slightly boiled egg. Rosie would know how to do it. When the water was bubbling and rolling, I put an egg in for what I figured was a minute. But I didn't have an egg timer or clock with a sweep hand, so I just had to guess. and then when I took the egg out of the water and put it on the table beside Mr. Pendergast's plate, he had still not come out of the bedroom. I kept waiting and finally ate my own breakfast of grits and gravy and drunk a cup of coffee. I finished, and still Mr. Pendergast had not appeared. I got up and heated more water to wash the dishes, and after I had finished washing and drying the plates, there was still no sign of him. I put the biscuits back in the oven, and soon the grits was cold and getting a skin. Could Mr. Pendergast have died in the night? A chill went through me down to my tailbone. Had he heard the bed fall down in the night and was too embarrassed to come out? Had he got up early and left? Or could he be expecting me to serve him breakfast in bed? I put the dry dishes on the shelf and got the broom and swept the kitchen floor. The fire was dying in the cook stove, and I put a couple more sticks in. By then it was daylight, and I could see the early sun turning the tops of the mountains copper. I heard a noise behind me and turned. There was Mr. Pendergast, with his hair uncombed and his overalls with only one gallus buckled. He drug his feet as he walked to the table. "I'll pour you some coffee," I said. I got the pot off the stove and hoped the coffee was still hot. The fire was blazing up again, but it might not have heated the pot yet. Mr. Pendergast took a sip of the coffee and put it down. "This coffee is cold," he said. "I'll heat it up again," I said. I took the cup and poured the coffee back into the pot. "A man can't drink cold coffee," Mr. Pendergast said. I took the pot of grits off the stove and put it on the table beside his plate. He took the serving spoon and dug into the grits and seen a skin had dried on them. "When did you make these? Last night?" he said. "I'm sorry," I said. "I made them for Hank at 6. "I wouldn't feed them to a hog," Mr. Pendergast said. "I can make you some more," I said. I got more sticks of wood out of the box and put them in the stove. "Don't bother," Mr. Pendergast said. "I'll just have biscuits and an egg." I took the biscuits out of the oven and put them on the table. The jam and molasses and butter was already on the table. Mr. Pendergast looked at the egg and said, "I thought I said a poached egg." "I can make you another one," I said. Mr. Pendergast cracked the egg on the edge of his plate and started peeling it, then stopped. "It's not half boiled," he said. "I tried to boil it for a minute," I said. "I can't eat this," he said. He looked at me like he blamed me for everything wrong in the world. He dropped the egg on his plate like he had touched a rotten tater. When the coffee was hot, I poured Mr. Pendergast another cup, but I couldn't hardly stand to look at him. He hadn't told me when he was going to get up, and he hadn't told me how to poach an egg. But I didn't want to argue with him, because it was his house, and I was going to have to live there. I put more water on to boil, but Mr. Pendergast said, "Forget about the egg. I'll just eat biscuits and molasses." He sat at the table like he had been offended, and he didn't even want to look at me. I stood by the stove wondering where I could go. It was his house, but I had to take care of it. I didn't have anywhere to go except up to the bedroom to make up the bed. But the bed had fell apart and would have to be put back together. And after that, I could sweep the front room and the porch. I left Mr. Pendergast at the table eating hot biscuits and drinking coffee and climbed the stairs to the bedroom. The bed was in pieces, and the quilts and sheets all tangled up. To let in the light, I pushed back the curtains. Everything was going wrong. Except for the memory of the night, I wished I was back home on the mountain. I almost wished I could go out and work in the fields or woods like I was used to doing. At least Mama and Rosie wasn't as hard to please as Mr. Pendergast. I thought of packing up my things in the cardboard box and lighting out for home. It would take all day to climb the mountain to North Carolina and then on up to the ridge. It was a pleasing thought, except when I got there, I would have the same old work and the shame of a failed marriage. Rosie and Lou would laugh if they seen me trudging up the road with my things in the box. and Mama would shake her head at the sadness of it all. And I would have to go back to cutting firewood and planning to butcher the hogs. It was the thought of the work that cleared my head a little. If I was going to have to work so hard anyway, I might as well be working for Hank and myself. I might as well work where I was now that I was down on Gap Creek. I set the headboard up against the wall and got the sides out from under the mattress. I seen the bed could be fitted together again, but where the post had cracked, it was going to have to be nailed. If it wasn't nailed, the bed would just fall down again. I looked at the crack in the light from the window and seen it had been made a long time ago. Whoever had set the bed up had knowed it would come crashing down as soon as the frame was shook, and I was certain it was Mr. Pendergast who had set it up without nailing the crack. He must have been waiting in the night to hear the bed crash. And it was him laughing I had heard after we fell on the floor and everything was quiet. I marched down the steps and turned toward the kitchen table to ask where there was a hammer. But Mr. Pendergast was gone. His coffee cup and greasy plate and knife and fork was there, but he had disappeared. "Where's a hammer?" I called, but nobody answered. I looked on the shelf at the back of the kitchen and then on the back porch where all kinds of tools hung on nails. I didn't find a hammer, but discovered a hatchet that had a hammer back. And after a little more looking, I found a half-rusty nail under a ball of binder's twine. After nailing the bedpost so it would hold the side, I put the bed together. It was an old bed and would creak no matter what you done to it, but I made it as firm and tight as I could. Since Hank and me would be sleeping there every night, I wanted to make it as quiet as possible. Mr. Pendergast might be downstairs listening every night, but at least the bed wouldn't fall again. When I got back to the kitchen, Mr. Pendergast was sitting beside the cook stove, whittling on a stick of kindling. He shaved curls off the piece of pine into the kindling box. He scratched with a knife on the white wood and hollowed out with the tip of the blade. It was a little figure of a person he was cutting. I didn't want to speak to him again because I thought he would say something short. He would take advantage of anything nice I said and give me an order to do something else. He seen I was just a young girl that had never been away from home. He seen I was at the disadvantage of being married and in a new place for the first time in my life. I figured it was better not to say anything. "I got some clothes that needs to be washed," Mr. Pendergast said. He opened the door of the stove and throwed shavings into the fire. I hadn't thought of doing a wash on my first day on Gap Creek. At home, we had just washed on Mondays. And then I remembered that this was Monday. We had got married on a Saturday and walked down to Gap Creek on Sunday. "Where's your clothes?" I said. "In the bedroom, behind the door," Mr. Pendergast said. It was already 9, according to the mantel clock. When I washed clothes, I liked to heat water early in the morning. I'd have to build a fire and carry water from the spring. I looked in the front bedroom where Mr. Pendergast slept, and you never seen such a mess. His clothes was scattered everywhere. The room looked like a rag pile. The bed probably hadn't been made up in months. Clothes was piled on the bureau and on the nightstand. The room smelled of pneumonia salve and camphor. I reckon Mr. Pendergast had rheumatism and rubbed the liniment on his joints. But there was a smell of dust also, and clothes that hadn't been washed in a long time. I looked behind the door, and there was a pile of clothes up to my waist, overalls and shirts, underwear and socks, heaped up and spilling over when I pulled the door back. Mr. Pendergast must not have washed clothes in months. It would take 3 armloads just to carry the clothes out to the backyard. I marched out of there and right back to the kitchen. "Where's the wash pot?" I said. "I like a little starch in my shirts," he said. I stepped out to the back porch and looked in the yard. Like in any backyard, there was a woodshed and a smokehouse, a clothesline, a path to the toilet on the right, and a path to the spring on the left. And further out, there was a barn and a hog pen. The washpot was on the trail to the spring. and there was a table and a wooden tub on the trail next to the pot. I looked around the porch and found a washboard and a bucket, and by the water bucket was a cake of octagon soap. I grabbed that bucket and carried several gallons of water from the spring and poured them in the pot. And then I got some kindling and wood from the shed and started a fire under the pot. There was a little wind, and the fire whipped around from side to side, but I put on more pine to make it blaze up. It took me 4 trips just to carry Mr. Pendergast's clothes out to the wash table. With my arms loaded, I tried not to smell all that sour cloth and soiled long handles. But when you have a filthy job, the only thing to do is jump in and get it done. Won't hurt your hands to get dirty. You can always wash them. The quicker I got the clothes in the boiling water, the quicker I would be done. I tried not to even look at the dirty clothes, but dumped them on the table and went back for more. "Don't boil my linen with the overalls," Mr. Pendergast said as I passed through the kitchen. I could see now he was whittling the figure of a naked woman from a piece of pine. He was picking with the point of his knife at the rounded shape of the buttocks. "Don't want the linen to fade," he said. I didn't even answer him. He lived in such filth and never washed or cleaned up, and here he was worried about his clothes fading. Anything I said would just show him how angry I was, and I didn't want to quarrel on my second day on Gap Creek. It was not what I had thought the beginning of married life would be. As soon as the water was boiling, I dumped in underwear and light-colored shirts. I heated the water extra hot to scald away the filth and grease in the clothes. Nothing will purify and sterilize like boiling water. The water bubbled and churned up into foam and flattened into spreading scars. I dumped the dirty long handles in and stirred them with the troubling stick, then let them boil for a minute and lifted them out with the stick and dumped them smoking on the wash table. I dipped 2 buckets of boiling water and mixed it with cold water in the tub. And then I took the washboard and the cake of octagon soap and started to scrub every piece of underwear and every shirt. I rubbed them up and down on the washboard, and the soapy water steamed up into my face. My hands got red from the soapy hot water. There is something chemical about the heat of washing, like the fire burns away filth and the soap turns the dirt into something clean. The bitter soap melts grease and soil. The slick soap eats away filth and oily stains. Much as you hate it, doing washing makes you feel you're starting out new. You have put your face in the smoke and steam and your hands in the dirty slick water, and then you lift the pieces out and rinse them in fresh water and wring them out in the wind. I took each piece of Mr. Pendergast's clothes out of the rinsing tub and twisted it hard as I could. The water squirted out, and the cloth was merely damp as I hung it on the line in the cool breeze. The line ran along the trail to the spring, and I hung the clean underwear and shirts and socks along the big thread. And after that, I hung the overalls so they looked like people walking as they flapped in the breeze. "Have you washed my socks?" Mr. Pendergast called from the back porch. "Done washed them," I said. "Don't you lose none," Mr. Pendergast said. "Wouldn't think of it," I said. When the washing was done, I felt a little better. For even Mr. Pendergast and his grumpy manners couldn't keep me from getting things done. I didn't know what to say to him, but if washing his stale clothes was part of my job, then I had done it. If waiting on him was part of my married life, then I had got it started that morning. I let the fire die down and emptied the 2 tubs in the grass by the trail. The washing hung on the line like a whole army marching in the sunlight. Where the underwear hung and the shirts hung, it looked like angels and not soldiers, but they didn't make any noise. The sun behind the cloth made them blinding. I carried the bucket and soap back to the porch, and Mr. Pendergast was standing on the back steps, watching me. With the tip of his knife blade, he was putting the finishing touches on the sharp little breasts of his naked woman. I glanced at the figure and looked away. I didn't want him to see me studying the carving. He held the pine woman up to the sunlight, and I could see how rounded her behind was and how big her breasts was. The face was still rough, but the shape of the body had been smoothed by the knife to look like real sculpture. When I glanced at the figure, I seen Mr. Pendergast was looking at me and grinning. His face had flushed a little. I hurried past him. It was time to fix dinner. My hands was soft and water-sobbed from the washing. I wished I had some lanolin to rub on them, but I didn't. The skin on my fingers felt tender as a baby's as I loaded wood into the cook stove. I wanted to bake some cornbread and sweet taters for dinner, but first I would have to ask Mr. Pendergast where the sweet taters was kept. I hated to ask him anything, since my best idea was to avoid him. I was pretty sure the taters was in a hole or cellar somewhere, but I didn't have time to go searching. Not if I got everything done by dinner time. Once I got the fire snapping in the stove, I looked out on the back porch and seen Mr. Pendergast still holding his doll and scratching at the face with his knife. "Where's the tater pit?" I said. He looked around slow at me and grinned. "You're standing right over it," he said. I didn't want to ask him where the steps to the cellar was. I would just find them for myself. He watched me as I walked out to the backyard and looked to the right of the house. I didn't see any door or steps there. I looked on the left side of the house, and at first didn't see anything but weeds in the chimney. And then I saw a door, like a lid on a trunk. The door was covered with tin, and when I lifted it back, sure enough, there were steps going down to the cellar. The steps was made of logs and covered with dirt, and they went right down into the dark under the house. I wished I had a lamp or a lantern. "Go ahead. Ain't nothing to be afraid of," Mr. Pendergast said. He had come up behind me. Cobwebs hung from the door frame. I went down the steps and stooped to avoid the dirty webs. It was so dark inside I couldn't see a thing at first, but the smell was sharp. It was the smell of old wood and damp ground that hadn't seen the sun in a long time. It was a smell of dead things, of dead beetles and dead mice, and the pea mice leave on nests of straw and string. Something buzzed by my ear, and I tried to slap it away. A moth fluttered to the door behind me. I seen the gleam of eyes in the dark, but knowed it must be lids on mason jars, and something moved at about the level of my eyes, on a shelf like a mouse or a snake sliding over dry ground. "Don't you see the taters?" Mr. Pendergast called from outside. "I can't see a thing," I called back. "On your right," he yelled. I stepped aside on something slick and soft, and then I seen the taters. They looked like twisted, swollen bodies with tails. I grabbed up half a dozen and put them in my apron. Before leaving, I looked around the cellar again. As my eyes adjusted to the dark a little, I seen shelves loaded with jars of canned stuff, quart jars and pint jars, jelly and green beans. Some of the stuff looked like it had bleached or faded from being in the dark too long. Something that looked like a snake head was poking out of one of the jars. A tongue flicked in the dim light. I turned toward the door and banged my head on the lintel. A cobweb caught in my hair. "Did you see my pet snake?" Mr. Pendergast said as I climbed the steps. The sunlight burned my eyes, and I wanted to brush the cobwebs away, but I didn't want Mr. Pendergast to think I was scared. "Didn't see no snake," I said. "He's a cute little feller," Mr. Pendergast said, "about 3 feet long." I hurried past him with the taters in my apron. I didn't want him to think he could get my goat. To make cornbread, to make good cornbread, I had to have some buttermilk, and I know the buttermilk would be in the spring house. I took the water bucket to fill and rushed out to the spring house. It was a low log building over the branch. The floor was water, except for a row of stepping stones from the door. And in the water sat jars of milk and pitchers of cream, butter inside tin pails. As I was bending down to get a jar of buttermilk, I seen something watching me from the corner of the building. It looked long as a furry snake, but I knowed it must be some kind of animal, like a weasel. It was long and its eyes sparkled. It was looking at me from a little face that was pointed. I stamped my foot and it slipped away under one of the logs of the sill. It must have been a mink, for it was too black and long to be a weasel. When Hank come home that evening, I could see he was tired. He had walked all the way to Lyman, and he had worked all day at the brick kiln, and then he had walked back. His face looked burned a little from the heat of the kiln where he had kept the fire blazing. I had been ignoring Mr. Pendergast all day, ever since breakfast, and I went on ignoring him after Hank come home. Hank went out to milk the cow, and when he brought the warm milk in, I strained it into one of the earthenware pitchers. I figured the milk would keep colder in a pitcher than in a mason jar. I tied a cloth over the top of the pitcher and was going to carry it out to the spring house when Mr. Pendergast come into the kitchen. Maybe he forgot Hank was there. I don't know. He said, "No, no, no, don't put all the milk in the spring house like a fool. You've got to save some to Clabber if you want any butter." Hank had just washed his hands and sat down at the table. "You hadn't ought to call her a fool," he said to Mr. Pendergast in a low voice I hadn't heard before. Mr. Pendergast wheeled around. "Somebody has to give orders around here," he said. "You don't give Julie orders," Hank said. He stood up and shook his finger at Mr. Pendergast. "This is my house," Mr. Pendergast said. "And she is my wife," Hank said. "Don't nobody give her orders but me." I started to say, "Don't nobody give me orders," but I figured I better keep my mouth shut. Mr. Pendergast looked like he had been caught by surprise, like he wasn't used to arguing with another man. "I ain't used to a girl that don't know nothing," he said. "If you don't like the way she does things, you can find somebody else to live in your dang blasted dirty house," Hank said. Mr. Pendergast turned like he was going to walk away, and then he looked at me by the stove. He started to say something, but didn't. "We can pack up and get out of here tonight," Hank said. "You can find somebody else to clean up your nastiness." "Now hold on," Mr. Pendergast said. "We can take our things and head back up the mountain," Hank said. He thought he had the advantage over Mr. Pendergast, and it was advantage he was going to use. It was the first time I ever seen Hank do that. "Now hold on," Mr. Pendergast said again. "We can do a lot better than live in this place on Gap Creek," Hank said. His voice trembled, but I didn't know if he was really that mad. Mr. Pendergast heard the tremble in his voice. "You can go if you want to," Mr. Pendergast said. "I won't have you giving Julie orders," Hank said, "and I won't have you interfering with us." "I'll do what I damn well please in my own house," Mr. Pendergast said, his mood changing. I seen Hank was caught, because we couldn't leave after living on Gap Creek only one day. We didn't have a place to go. He had thought he had the advantage of Mr. Pendergast, but it turned out he didn't. I waited to see what he would say. "If Julie has to look after this place, we shouldn't have to pay for any groceries," Hank said. "You don't have to pay for no groceries," Mr. Pendergast said, "but I'll damn well say what I please in my house." "You just be careful who you say it to," Hank said. "And you watch out who you're talking to," Mr. Pendergast said. But Mr. Pendergast and Hank had to stop, because even though they was mad, neither could afford to quarrel anymore. Mr. Pendergast probably couldn't find nobody else to look after his house and cook for him, and Hank and me didn't have any place else to go. Hank went back outside without saying another word, and Mr. Pendergast sat there looking at the table in front of him, and he sat that way till supper was ready. It was the next week, while I was doing the washing again, that I heard a voice around the front of the house. I ignored it at first, thinking maybe it was a crow calling across the creek, or a fox barking in the woods. Sometimes a sound will carry a long way when the wind is right. "Pendergast!" somebody called. Something was wrong with the voice. It sounded all stretched and twisted. "Pendergast!" it said again, as if the person hollering couldn't talk plain. As far as I knowed, Mr. Pendergast was in the house, setting at the kitchen table where he had ate breakfast. Surely he could hear the voice if I could. "Pendergast!" the man yelled, as if he was strangling on the name as he said it. I started to run around the house to see who it was, but something about the voice made me not want to go. We didn't get many visitors there on Gap Creek. I hurried to the back door and looked in the kitchen, but Mr. Pendergast wasn't sitting at the table. I tried to adjust my eyes to the dim light, but didn't see him anywhere. "Mr. Pendergast," I said, a little louder than a whisper. I didn't want whoever it was calling to hear me. "Pendergast!" the man yelled from the front yard. I started toward the living room to look through the window and see who it was, but almost run into Mr. Pendergast in the doorway. He was standing stooped over with his finger to his lips. "They're calling for you," I said. "Shh," Mr. Pendergast said. He looked like he was trying to shrink into himself. "Pendergast! I know where you are," the voice hollered. "Who is that?" I said. It didn't make sense for Mr. Pendergast to be hiding in his own house. I stepped toward the window to look out. "Don't let him see you," Mr. Pendergast hissed. "What does he want?" I said. "Pendergast, you owe me," the man shouted. "He's just Timmy Gosnell," Mr. Pendergast said. "On one of his drunks." There was a bang on the porch, like a rock or a piece of iron had hit the planks and rolled till it slammed the wall. I had a cold, sour feeling deep in my belly. "Can't you ask him to leave?" I said. "He's drunk," Mr. Pendergast said, "and when Timmy's drunk, he's crazy." "Pendergast," the man screamed. "You got to make it right." I leaned over to where I could look between the curtains. The man in the yard wore a long black coat with no buttons. His overalls looked like they was hanging on him by only one gallus. His hat resembled a ragged bird perched on his head, and there was a cut on his forehead. He leaned as though he was bracing himself against a hard wind and shaded his eyes and stared at the window. "Pendergast!" he yelled. "Ain't you gonna talk to him?" I said to Mr. Pendergast.
"Won't do no good," Mr. Pendergast said. "You can't talk sense to Timmy Gosnell when he's drunk."
The man in the yard picked up a rock and flung it at the door. The bang made my heart stop for a second. I had not been around drunk men very much. Papa only took a little blackberry wine for his rheumatism. And when one of the Willard boys got drunk and come around the house, Papa always persuaded him to go on home.
"Pendergast," the man hollered. "When you die, smoke will come out of your grave."
"What does he mean?" I said.
"He thinks I never paid him for some ginseng," Mr. Pendergast said. "I paid him, but he was too drunk to remember."
Another rock hit the front door. The bang made something in the marrow of my bones ache. It was awful to stand in your own living room and be hollered at.
"I'm going out there," I said. "Don't you go," Mr. Pendergast said. "Timmy can be ugly when he's drunk."
Lurching from one foot to the other, Timmy Gosnell climbed the steps to the porch. There was a stick Mr. Pendergast used as a walking stick leaning against the door jamb, and the drunk man picked it up and banged on the door. It made a terrible racket, and the lick seemed to shake the foundations of the house.
"Go away," Mr. Pendergast hollered.
"Smoke will come out of your grave," the drunk man yelled.
He beat on the wall like he was punishing the house.
"Ain't you gonna do nothing?" I said.
My breath was short and my ears humming.
"You owe me,"
Timmy Gosnell screamed.
He rapped on the wood like he wanted to wake the dead on the faraway hill. I couldn't take any more of the rapping. The noise tore something inside of me. I marched to the door and flung it open. The drunk man staggered back in surprise and dropped the stick. He shaded his eyes to see who I was.
"You ain't Pendergast," he said.
"You ought to be ashamed of yourself," I hollered. I was so mad and scared I was trembling. I could smell the drunk man in the breeze. He stunk like soured fruit and foul rags and pee. He shaded his eyes and looked at me sideways, squinting.
"Are you Pendergast's whore?" he said.
"You get away from here," I said. I picked up the walking stick like I was going to hit him with it. I felt like swinging the stick right at his grizzled face.
"Pendergast is a coward," he said, letting a woman take up for him.
"You get away from here," I hollered. The drunk man looked at the door, and he looked at me, and he looked up the road. He acted like he couldn't remember where he was or what he was doing. He looked at the ground like there might be a clue there. Then he reached into the coat pocket and pulled out a bottle. He jerked out the stopper and took a drink, then put the bottle back in the pocket.
"Pendergast," he hollered. "Go on now, get," I said.
But I was shaking as I held the stick and watched him stagger back to the road. I didn't know what I would do if he lunged at me or swung at me. He stopped once and started to say something, then swept his hand like it wasn't any use and went on. I watched him lurch and reel all the way to the bend in the road. When Hank got home, I told him what happened, and he was so mad his face turned white before it got red. He wheeled around at Mr. Pendergast.
"You mean you let him throw rocks at the house?" Hank said.
"He didn't break nothing," I said.
"And you let Julie go out to deal with a drunk man?" Hank said.
"I begged her not to go," Mr. Pendergast said. "I told her it wouldn't do no good."
"I told him to go away, and he went," I said. Hank was so mad he walked up and down in the kitchen, slamming his fist in his palm.
"I wished I'd been here," he said. "You can't talk sense to a drunk man," Mr. Pendergast said. "Not to Timmy Gosnell."
"Not if you hide in the house, you can't," Hank said.
It didn't amount to much, I said. I was sorry I had told Hank about it.
"Next time I hope I'm here," Hank said.
"I hope you are," Mr. Pendergast said.
But I hope Timmy Gosnell never did come back to Mr. Pendergast's house, and I hope that Hank would not be there if he did.
"That man needs somebody to knock him sober," Hank said.
"And you're just the man to do it," Mr. Pendergast said.
Chapter 5. Hank had told me at the time we got married that his mama, Ma Richards, would be coming down for a visit. She was going to get a ride down from Painter Mountain, and she was going to stay for several weeks. I had never met Ma Richards, and I was looking forward to her visit, for I had not seen many women since we moved to Gap Creek. It was getting up toward late fall by then, toward hog-killing time. One day, Hank got a letter from his ma, scribbled with a pencil on tablet paper. "Hank, you come up here and get me on a Saturday," it said. "I'll be ready by 10 o'clock. That was the whole letter.
"How are you going to get her?" I said. For Hank didn't even have a horse, much less a buggy or wagon. He walked to work every day to the